from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We know Botox is widely used to go after wrinkles. Shoot in a tiny amount of deadly neurotoxin, and wrinkle lines can melt away. But Botox is getting a much bigger workout than wrinkle treatment these days on everything from migraines to depression. This hour On Point, the growing uses of Botox. Later in this hour, we'll look at last night's Golden Globes, but first to Botox. Back when it first became popular, it was all about the idea of injecting a deadly neurotoxin right into ourselves. Here's 2002 Saturday Night Live parody of a Botox commercial featuring then-cast members Anna Gasteyer, Amy Poehler, Maya Rudolph, and Winona Ryder.
Botox.
It gently smooths away wrinkles the natural way.
By crippling the nervous tissue in your face.
With a diluted strain of deadly bacteria.
Deadly bacteria.
It's like a little stroke you shoot into your head with a needle. I like that.
For a while, people were really freaked out. They got over it. So many people have used Botox on the wrinkle front, but it's being used well beyond as well. Joining me now from New York is Alexandra Sifferlin. She's a health writer at Time, the magazine. Her article, Botox, the drug that's treating everything, just made the cover. Alexandra, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
It's good to be here.
There are so many things on the table. Depression, migraines, we'll talk about a lot more that Botox is being thrown at now. But take us back, and you do this in your story, take us back to the very beginning. This was not originally developed as a treatment for wrinkles. It started out somewhere else.
It did. In the 1970s, an eye doctor named Alan Scott developed Botox. At the time, he called it oculinum, for two eye conditions. One was for people with crossed eyes, and another was for people with uncontrollable eyelid spasms. And he got approval for those two conditions in 1989. And as people started getting the drug, they noticed that their wrinkles were disappearing. And so it was 2 years later, in 1991, that Allergan, the company that still currently owns Botox, bought the drug from Scott and really doubled down on its wrinkle potential.
What has the growth and use of Botox been like for wrinkles and beyond?
Sure. So for wrinkles from 2000 to 2015, use of Botox for wrinkles has increased 759%, which is pretty dramatic. Allergan, the company, makes almost nearly double the amount of revenue off of Botox for medical uses today as it does for cosmetic ones. So really, the growth in medical uses is outpacing cosmetic uses for Botox.
It's kind of incredible. I'm looking here at the list of ways that it's used beyond wrinkles that you're reminding us of, and it's long: chronic migraines, excessive underarm sweating, overactive bladder, crossed eyes, depression, premature ejaculation, abnormal heartbeat, severely cold hands, cleft lip scars in babies, painful sex, severe neck spasms. I mean, the needle's going in everywhere, Alexandra.
It is, and Allergan has 800 patents for current and potential uses for Botox. Doctors are using it off-label for many uses, and Allergan does have 9 federally approved medical uses for the drug.
I did not understand exactly how this worked until I was reading here. Once a drug is approved by the FDA, an individual doctor can use it for, is it wide open for whatever they like once it's approved at all?
It is. Once a drug is approved for one condition, a doctor is legally allowed to use that drug for any other condition that they think could benefit their patients. And so for Botox, this has been a widespread practice, simply because Botox works by interfering with communication between nerves and muscles, and that underlines so many different medical conditions.
So what is now on-label and what's off-label, and what difference does it make?
Sure. So on-label, Botox is approved for, as you mentioned, excessive underarm sweating, chronic migraine prevention, overactive bladder, and a total of 9 medical conditions.
Okay.
Off-label, things like lockjaw, back pain, et cetera. Why it matters is on-label, these drugs have undergone significant clinical trials to prove safety and effectiveness of the drug for those uses. Off-label, they haven't necessarily undergone that type of research. The company, Allergan, is allowed to market the drug for its on-label uses. It's not allowed to market the drug for its off-label ones. That doesn't prevent doctors from still using it off-label, but it can have an effect on sales.
What's the safety in all this? If it's off-label but widely used, you would think it might raise concerns about whether or not we really know that it's safe.
Sure. It certainly does. Off-label use is a very common medical practice. At the same time, there are certainly people who have said that their doctor gave them Botox off-label, and for whatever reason, maybe it was a dosing problem, they had severe side effects. And there have been several lawsuits brought against the company Allergan related to bad reactions to off-label use.
Let's go to our caller, Sue in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Sue, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's your story?
My story is I have migraines, and I've been taking Botox shots for about 10 years now, and I'm 58. I started getting migraines in my 20s, and in my 30s, it got really bad where I was getting them 3 to 4 times a week. I couldn't function. I lost a job because I couldn't make it into work because the pain.
Yeah.
Is just incredible. My neurologist suggested Botox, and I did it, and I got my life back. I function. I get Botox every 6 months, and I have my life back. I can't say enough about it.
Sue, how do they administer it? Do they put the needle in the side of your head? I don't mean to be glib, but how do they do it?
Oh, no. They inject about 70 units in my forehead. It goes from the side temple to the other side temple and several injections all throughout the forehead.
And it's just under the skin, subcutaneous, just right there?
Yes.
Any side effects, Sue?
I haven't had any side effects at all.
Is your forehead smooth as a baby's behind?
It is. It's pretty funny when I think I'm wrinkling my head and it's
nothing happening.
Nothing there. Yeah.
Well, so you're grateful for it, and we hear it. Sue, I really appreciate your call. Alexandra, this came out of the observation of a Beverly Hills plastic surgeon, this thought that this might work for migraines?
Yes. In 1992, a Beverly Hills plastic surgeon, Dr. William Binder, he was injecting Botox into his patients, and they were coming back and telling him that they were experiencing fewer migraines than they had in the past. So this was something that, you know, he really saw the potential in and kind of continued researching it. And this also caught the attention of Allergan, which then has done their own clinical trials to get it approved.
You say that the ever-expanding number of uses has been largely physician-driven. Is that the kind of example? I mean, they see some sort of accidental side effect and go for it, or are they kind of experimenting with their patients? How does that dynamic work?
Absolutely. So a lot of the uses for Botox are these kind of unexpected surprises, like the migraine one. Similarly, doctors in Europe who were using Botox noticed that their patients basically stopped sweating in their face. And so then they continued to research that, and Allergan has gotten approval for excessive underarm sweating. So it is a lot of these off-label uses or doctors using the drug and noticing a potentially interesting side effect and then continuing to use the drug off-label that has led to many of these uses. You know, Allergan then pays attention to what's going on. The company also does its own research, of course, and from there does the clinical trials to get these uses on the market.
And lots of people paying attention. Sarah in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Sarah, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What's your story?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I was on overactive bladder medication since my two children were born for 10 years and had tried every single one of them in combinations and then ultimately was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
Oh.
And as a result, I had neurogenic bladder. And the urologist had recommended Botox, and I've been getting it done for over 6 years now, and I can't speak highly enough about it. It is a complete life changer. I don't take any oral medications, which would give me dry mouth and headaches.
Yeah.
Or not to mention the cost, but
So you get an injection in your abdomen or something, Sarah, and it controls the overactive bladder? Is that how it works?
Yeah, actually, right into the bladder.
Wow.
It's done in an outpatient procedure, and I have to have a driver because I'm given some pretty strong pain medications. But
right.
I can see it all happening right on a TV right in front of me, and he just makes 3 quick injections right in the lining of the bladder. And
how long is it effective for? How often do you have to do it?
I do it every 6 months. That can vary for some people, but I've just consistently found 6 months works great.
And, I mean, that's a long time, so it's not like you have to run in there every day.
No, and it's such an improvement to my quality of life where I just don't have that immediate need to go to the bathroom and, or I know so many of my girlfriends this age,
Yeah.
laugh or dance or they sneeze and
whoopsie.
I know 3 of my other girlfriends have went and got it done as well, and they don't have MS or they just have overactive bladder. And
any side effects for you, Sarah?
None.
I appreciate your call, Alexandra. Is it all sweetness and light here? Are there side effects issues that people should know about? You say there have been lawsuits.
Sure. So in 2009, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration said that Botox and other toxins like it would have to carry a black box warning label. And basically, that is the most severe warning label applied to a drug. And this label says that in some instances, the effects of Botox can spread from the injection site to other areas and cause complications.
We're going to come back and look at a number of aspects of this. Alexandra Sifferlin is with us, health writer at Time Magazine. Big cover story there, how Botox became the drug that's treating everything. We'll talk with a couple of doctors and researchers who are deep into this on the migraine front, on the traveling neurotoxins front within our bodies. You can join us. Have you used Botox beyond your brow, your laugh lines, as your doctor recommended Botox for more serious health issues? Have you used it? Has it worked? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the spreading use of Botox, off-label and on, for everything from migraines to depression, the wrinkle killer, all over the place now. Alexandra Sifferlin's been writing about it for Time Magazine, joins us today from New York. You can join us as well. How do you, would you feel about being injected with Botox for cold hands, sweaty armpits, overactive bladder, and a lot more? Do you understand how Botox works for such a wide range of ailments? Migraine sufferers and more. Have you tried it? Has it helped? Where do they put the needle in? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Another use here. Last week, NBC interviewed Yvonne Kaminsky. It's a Wisconsin woman. She is speaking again after receiving Botox injections. She hadn't been able to speak for 16 years before that due to a vocal disorder called spasmodic dysphonia.
I have a couple of grandchildren who have never heard my voice. I always felt bad when they were real small that I couldn't read to them because I wanted that so badly.
And now she's got it. Thank you, Botox. Alexandra Sifferlin has written about it. We're going to hear in just a moment from Dr. Timothy Collins out of Duke University Medical Center. We get a call from Bradenton, Florida. Peter, you're on the air.
How are you, Tom?
I'm okay. No Botox, but I'm okay.
I have not taken it. I would never dream of taking it for any reason. I'm astonished. I never cease being astonished at the willingness that so many Americans have to take deadly poisons. I mean, the name of this one, Bo as in botulism, toxic, poisonous.
Yeah.
And we watch the drug things on television with all the side effects.
Yeah.
It might cause bleeding from the eyeball.
Yeah.
And we take them.
Okay, Peter, I take your point, but my friend, if you had migraines, overactive bladder, twitchy eyelids, sweaty armpits, cold hands, and all the rest, maybe you'd change your mind.
None of these is a condition that does not have other perfectly usable, non-toxic approaches. I mean, what are we going to be taking this for next?
Yeah.
Sweat on the brow.
It sounds like we're already there inadvertently. Let me pick it up with a medical doctor. And Peter, I appreciate your call from Bradenton there. Let's go to Cary, North Carolina right now. And Dr. Timothy Collins, he's Associate Professor of Neurology at Duke University Medical Center, joins us via Skype from Cary. He uses Botox to treat migraines. Dr. Collins, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Alexandra Sifferlin's been writing about this for Time, and it caught our attention. You heard our caller from Florida saying, come on, botulism, neurotoxins, do we really have to go there to treat these problems? Don't we have alternatives? Why have you gone down this road, Dr. Collins?
Well, so first of all, many of the medications we use for headaches already are poisonous. It all depends as
dose.
Alexandra wrote, the dose.
Yeah. Yeah, look right on the bottle of aspirin or anything else, too much and you're in trouble.
Correct. But the thing with our migraine patients, these are all people who have failed multiple treatments for their headaches and are still having more than 14 days of headache each month. I mean, they're having headache all day long.
Yeah.
More than 14 days out of the month, and nothing has worked. They're desperate. And so getting Botox, which is actually injected in 31 different places all around the head,
okay,
while it sounds drastic, as your first caller said, it gives them their life back. They go from having, many of my patients are having headache constantly every single day, 30 days out of the month. And after they get their Botox, a week later, they go down to 8 headache days out of a month. It's dramatically improved.
How does it work, Dr. Collins? Our caller said they inject it under the skin, not further than that, and it works for her. What's the process by which Botox goes after the migraine?
Well, we don't fully understand that. We know that Botox interferes with the transmission of the signal from the nerve to the muscle or the nerve to the sweat gland that makes the sweat. There's been some research that's been done over the last 10 years that show that Botox is actually transported backwards up the nerve to the brain, and that seems to be where it's having its main action with migraine. Some researchers have shown pretty convincingly that Botox alters the way our pain fibers respond to pain stimuli in the head after they've injected it, at least in animals. So we can see that it's doing something, but we're not entirely sure yet how it works for migraines.
Which came first for you? Were you using Botox for other things, or you're in neurology? Were you already studying migraines and came around to Botox as a solution?
I've been doing migraine or headache medicine since the mid-1990s and started doing Botox as a solution or an answer for some of my really difficult patients back in 2004. So I've been giving headache patients Botox for quite a while.
And we've got a caller on this front who didn't have such a great experience, perhaps. Tracy in Madison, Wisconsin. You're on the air with Dr. Timothy Collins at Duke University Medical Center. Hi, Tracy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I understand that Botox has been a great treatment for many. I fell about 4 years ago and suffered a traumatic brain injury. Hmm. And I've been on a regimen of several painkillers. Done alternative therapies, you know, yoga, all the other things.
Okay.
And finally, about 4 months ago, I said, okay, let me try it. 31 injections. I had a terrible, terrible eyelid droop on both eyes. It hurt at every injection site. Weakness in my neck muscles to where I could barely lift my head.
Oh.
And I still am suffering. It feels like the heel of my hand is still pushing down in the middle of my forehead. But it's been about 4 months. Things are starting to wear off. And, of course, my neurologist said, you know, okay, that didn't work for you. So, sorry, we can't do anything else for you. Good luck.
Wow. That's not – you never want to hear them say, sorry, good luck. Dr. Collins, speak to what Tracy's describing here. I know it's a broad description, but what comes to mind as you listen?
Those are actually really common effects of Botox. When it's injected too low on the forehead or too close to the eyebrows, we do see eyelid droop in some of our patients. And at least in our clinic, we've had to adjust where we inject the Botox to kind of decrease that risk. A small number of our patients, less than 10%, get neck weakness like our caller had. And we've adjusted or eliminated the Botox injections after that happens to prevent them from getting that. Unfortunately, we also know from studies that were done, published last year and the year before, that in some patients, they don't actually get improvement of their headaches until after the second set of Botox injections. So the side effects that our caller had, unfortunately, are things that we see, and often we have to adjust the dose or where we inject the Botox to keep that from happening so the patient can try it again.
Tracy, we wish you luck there. Alexandra Sifferlin, migraines and beyond, in your reporting, what are the list of some of the problem outcomes that you saw people confronting when they use Botox? When they're happy, great. When they're not, what kind of things went wrong, Alexandra?
Sure. So often when Botox is used off-label, in some cases, the dosage is unknown, and it can go wrong for some people. In 2014, a family was awarded $6.75 million by a jury because a doctor had used Botox off-label for a child's cerebral palsy symptoms, and he ended up developing a type of epilepsy and sort of some symptoms similar to botulism. Allergan ended up settling with that family. But yeah, basically, you can, you know, the drug, its effects can spread, and if doses are not right, people can experience some serious side effects.
I mean, we heard from a caller who was so happy with her overactive bladder solution, but you also remind us that there's a catch, and sometimes Botox can actually shut down the bladder, and people may have to use a catheter.
Yes. Some of the side effects for the overactive bladder use is people may have to use a catheter, as you said, and also there is a higher risk for urinary tract infections.
So watch out. Nothing's perfect. Richard in Charlotte, North Carolina, just there last week, had a great time. Richard, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom, for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm a pediatric neurologist, and I've had experience with using Botox for children with cerebral palsy, and it's used also in children and adults with dystonia, overactive muscle activity that's driven by the brain.
Okay.
And it works very, very well. It's very, very safe. I think that a lot of the problems that people have described are related to how difficult it is to get the right dose and get the right dose in the right place. You have to inject it into the muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes you overshoot with the dose. Sometimes the dose is inadequate and you don't get the response that you want. In any case, the doses are way, way lower than what is truly toxic for an individual. And so it's extremely rare to have a systemic negative response to a regimen of Botox injection.
When things go wrong, or when it works, I guess. What's working there? What, you have an overactive muscle somehow, and Botox settles down the brain signal? What?
Well,
cuts it off.
Spastic cerebral palsy is when the brain is driving the muscles overly, too much.
Mm-hmm.
And you have too many nerve impulses coming to the muscle. Mm-hmm. Botox works by getting taken up into the nerve endings and basically inactivating the nerve endings. And if you give the right dose, it gets taken up into the most active nerves. So the ones that are firing the most get shut down. But you dose it so that you leave some nerve activity. So the muscle still works. It's just it's just weakened somewhat. And for somebody who's stiff because their muscles are overactive, that works to their benefit. It leaves their muscle usable, but it reduces the overactivity that's keeping their muscle from being useful. That's what the problem with cerebral palsy and dystonia.
Richard, a pediatric neurologist there in Charlotte, North Carolina, very grateful for your call, Richard. Timothy Collins, Dr. Collins at Duke, is there a limit to how long this is effective? You know, maybe it works for a couple of years and then it doesn't. Can you just go on using it lifelong if you've got a chronic problem?
Well, as far as we can tell, there's not much in the way of limits. When I first started doing Botox, I did see one patient who had developed neutralizing antibodies to the toxin, which means when we injected the toxin, her muscles didn't get weak. The toxin had no effect at all. So that's theoretically a risk. Allergan's reformulated the Botox brand a couple of times to decrease the extra protein in it that causes the antibodies to develop. So there's a little bit of concern with that. In some of our headache patients, they actually get thinning of the muscles in their temporal area of their head or their temple because we're repeatedly paralyzing the muscle or interfering with the signals, and the muscle gets a little thinner.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, we haven't seen much in the way of long-term effects. It doesn't seem to build up and have any kind of adverse event. I've got a number of patients who've been getting Botox for 10 years now and really don't see any change in how they respond to it.
Timothy Collins in North Carolina, Alexandra Sifferlin in New York at Time. Please stand by. I want to go to Madison, Wisconsin now and bring in Ed Chapman, professor of neuroscience at University of Wisconsin-Madison. Ed Chapman, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
You've done some research that got a lot of attention about how Botox moves inside the body. Can you describe what you found?
Yeah, this really begins in terms of basic research with Mario Cavio's laboratory in Italy. They published a paper in 2008 suggesting Botox, botulinum neurotoxin A, can move from neuron to neuron in whole animal studies. And, you know, it was, to be frank, it was greeted with a certain degree of skepticism. It's a pretty strong claim. I personally met a group of physicians who felt anecdotally from their practices that the toxins did, in fact, move around within the nervous system to perhaps exert some of their effects at the level of the brain. And so reading all this and following all this, we wanted to have a look ourselves. So our contribution was to use a reduced, simplified system to see if we could directly visualize transfer of the toxin from cell to cell. And if that occurs, to try to figure out what that pathway is and how it operates.
Okay.
And in short, it's, you know, if you believe our data, which I do, it's very clear the toxins act locally. This is a pathway that's been worked out by us and many other labs for the last couple of decades. But there's clearly a second independent, distinct pathway by which the toxins, at least botulinum neurotoxin A and a couple other toxins that we looked at, could be transferred from one neuron to another upstream neuron. We don't know how far it goes, but in my mind, there's no question the toxins can move from cell to cell.
Is this good or bad or both?
Here's what it boils down to. We know in atomic detail and molecular detail how the toxins act at the neuromuscular junction. We've identified the receptors. We've determined the structures of the toxins bound to these receptors.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this second pathway, we know from experiments in our laboratory that it uses a different receptor. So we're in a position, or the field is in a position, to engineer or alter the toxin so it doesn't recognize the second receptor and enter this second pathway that mediates these distal effects. So here's the question. If that toxin could be engineered and physicians tested it in clinical trials,
yeah,
we would find out once and for all if the distal effects are necessary for some of the positive medicinal effects that are seen clinically.
Because, I mean, on the one hand, Dr. Collins is describing, saying we don't know exactly how it works on migraines. Maybe it's traveling upstream, in effect, toward the brain. On the other, if you don't want to get an injection and then suddenly have some other unrelated part of your body go numb or stop working, Ed.
Absolutely. So I mean, it's complicated because there are ideas, for example, if you change the way your face muscles work, you can have feedback to the brain that will change the way the brain regulates your face. So it's complicated. So if we could have a toxin that simply didn't enter the second pathway, we could probably pretty unambiguously determine which conditions are treated, are ameliorated by these distal effects, and which conditions are not. And then, you know, the patient and the physician could make a decision, you know, do I want to inject an agent,
yep,
that I know might be traveling back into my brain, for example.
Alexandra, in New York, is this research raising hope for more applications or alarm bells?
I think it's a little bit of both. Allergan, the company, is very much insisting that its effects are very local. On the one hand, it is a little bit scary what Ed is describing for
migrating
people,
Botox, yeah.
But on the other hand, what's interesting is that maybe the reason why some of these people are getting relief for things like migraine or dystonias, things that we don't exactly know precisely how it works, maybe it is because the way Botox works is much more complicated than we thought.
I guess we're getting that impression right here today. Also, much more widely used than I, for one, had any idea of. Alexandra Sifferlin, please stand by at Time. We're so glad to have all of you with us here today. Ed Chapman at University of Wisconsin-Madison and Dr. Timothy Collins at Duke University. We're talking about the spreading use of Botox off-label and on for all kinds of things, migraines to depression. I want to come back and look at how it might work when it comes to depression. We'll also look, before this hour is over, at the Golden Globes last night. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've been talking this hour about Botox and the fact that it has moved far beyond simply the application of fighting wrinkles to now all kinds of things. The list is long. Alexander Sifferlin's been writing about it for Time magazine. Migraines, sweating, overactive bladder, crossed eyes, depression, premature ejaculation, abnormal heartbeat, severely cold hands, and right on down. You can join us this hour, 800-423-8255. In a few minutes, we're going to look at the Golden Globes last night. Edwin Chapman is with us, professor of neuroscience at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's been doing research into how Botox moves within the body. Once it's, it's placed locally, but it apparently can travel. Dr. Timothy Collins is with us, associate professor of neurology at Duke. The medical center there uses Botox to treat migraines. 800-423-TALK is our number. A couple of calls. I want to look at depression. Casey in Bloomington, Illinois. Casey, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, I apologize. Actually, I was just going to tell a story about my grandpa. He had Parkinson's, and they gave him Botox in his leg to help with his toes because they would cramp up.
Okay. Yeah.
And we would give him a hard time because we're like, oh yeah, how pretty are your toes now that you got Botox? So glad you did that.
Did it work for him, Casey?
It worked really well, and it actually increased his mobility, and it made it easier for him to walk. At least for a little while. I know he had a couple rounds of treatments. They did like an ultrasound to make sure they placed the needle in the right spot.
Yep. I mean, we hear it again. Yeah, all the applications people are going for here, and you see your grandfather be able to have a little ease. That must feel good. I mean, listeners here writing in on Twitter, one says, the most toxic substance in the world is also a useful medicine. The universe is not simple. I guess it's not. Casey, thanks for your call. Dawn in Saunderstown, Rhode Island. Dawn, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
I'm calling. You're welcome. My mom had a stroke 5 years ago, and it affected the left side of her body. It was paralyzed. And as a result of that, like your last caller and the doctors have talked about, she had awful tone in her hand and in her foot, her leg. And it would be so bad. It's very painful. I mean, if you ever, you know, picture somebody who's had a stroke, their hand curls up. She would have to keep a towel in her hand because her fingernails would actually dig into her hand.
Oh, boy, and,
yeah, it was awful. And a physical therapist recommended Botox. And I honestly was horrified when my mother told me this. And we did some research, and she had it done, and it was absolutely incredible. Her hand opened up, and, you know, I could not even, like, pull her fingers apart. Like, you know, her hand opened up. Her foot, which usually would be twisted inward, and her toes would actually stick up and cramp, all of that relaxed. So it's been a lifesaver for my mom. And if I could just ask a question.
Yes.
One of the questions I have is, you know, my mother, at the time she had her stroke, she went into kidney failure, and she got put on the kidney transplant list. And fortunately, she did have a transplant in August, but her doctors had said to her that she couldn't have the treatment anymore because she would, you know, she was going to be on anti-rejection drugs and that kind of thing. And
yep.
Then other doctors said, well, you know, it's not a live virus. So, like, has been a little bit of controversy here. About
interesting.
That.
Our time is short. Let me pick up your question, Dawn. I appreciate your call. Ed, Dr. Collins, do you have a view on that after a kidney replacement, whether this could go on, Dr. Collins?
I don't see any problem with it. We have patients with a number of health issues on immunosuppressive medications, ranging from multiple sclerosis to severe lupus, that are getting Botox. There's no real contraindication to getting Botox based on the medical problems.
Dawn, I don't understand that. Yeah, there's one view for you. Ed?
I would just add that, you know, it's not a virus and it's not a bacterium. It's a purified toxin isolated from a bacterium.
Yeah.
And it has a limited half-life within cells. So, you know, it's cleared after some months.
Alexandra, on the depression front, I think this is one that's still off-label, if unless I'm wrong. What are people telling you about how that works? Why would Botox affect depression?
Sure. It is still off-label. Allergan is conducting clinical trials to hopefully get it approved. Depression is one of the indications that it is still more unclear why it works. There are some studies that will show that when people with major depressive disorder get Botox injections, they will report fewer depression symptoms and better mood 6 weeks later compared to people who get a saline placebo injection.
And is this a so-called facial feedback hypothesis that if you're not frowning, you're going to feel better?
Yes.
Simple as that.
Well, not everyone agrees with this theory, but it's definitely one of the potential factors that some doctors think is behind how this works for depression. Basically, that your facial expressions are intimately linked with your emotions. So if you can't frown, maybe you feel less upset. And if you can smile more, maybe you feel happier. Again, not everybody agrees, but it's potential.
Dr. Collins, do you buy that? No expression, so you look mellow, so you feel mellow, not depressed. Really?
I don't know about that. I mean, when we do Botox in the forehead, they can still smile and move their lips around and make other facial expressions. So I haven't even heard that it was being used for depression until the article in Time magazine. So it's not something I was aware of.
Ed Chapman, have you paid attention to the depression treatment front here?
Yeah, I guess I alluded to that sort of poorly earlier. There's this, your facial there's this feedback loop between your face and your brain, and there's this idea that if you look happy, you're going to feel happy, and if you look sad, you're going to feel sadder. So these are sort of the entanglements that make my obsession on the idea of designer toxins that can't move about, compelling. So we can answer these questions if we had these reagents in hand.
Do you see more of this coming, Ed Chapman, down the pike? I mean,
I'll tell you, I'm a basic researcher, and what really opened my eyes was a dinner I had with six physicians that use the toxin clinically, and I did not know that, they can use their own judgment and talk to the patients, but they can try the toxin for, as far as I understand it, almost any indication. And the anecdotal stories I heard of the sorts of different things that were treated by injecting toxins made my head spin. We talk about, 978 or 1,000, but
potential applications.
Boy, I'll tell you, 5 years from now, you'll hear another 1,000.
Our heads are spinning a little bit today as well. It's been really fascinating. Edwin Chapman at University of Wisconsin-Madison. Ed, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Timothy Collins at Duke University Medical Center. Dr. Collins, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Alexandra Sifferlin, do you see any end to the Botox expansion here?
I agree with Ed. I really think that we're going to see doctors using it for more and more things, and Allergan also pursuing more and more uses for federal approval.
Watch this space. A little toxin apparently can go a long way. Alexandra Sifferlin has written it up for Time magazine. You can link to her story at our website, onpointradio.org. Alexandra, thanks very much for being with us today.
It was good to be here.
In a moment, last night's Golden Globes. This is On Point. Last night, Hollywood gathered to celebrate the 74th Golden Globe Awards. La La Land broke the record with 7 Golden Globes. Viola Davis, Donald Glover, and Casey Affleck were some of the winners. Hollywood went political, too, with Meryl Streep speaking about the importance of art and artists in the age of Donald Trump. Daniel Feinberg, TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter, was watching. He joins us. Daniel, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Let's get a little sound of it in our ears. Here was Jimmy Fallon, host of the 74th Golden Globes.
This is the Golden Globes, one of the few places left where America still honors the popular vote.
Okay, quick little jab there, and on they went. But then Hugh Laurie came up. He won the Golden Globe for Best Performance by an Actor in Supporting Role in TV. Hugh Laurie, pretty sardonic and smart guy. Here's the opening of his politically infused acceptance speech.
Thank you, first of all, to the Hollywood Foreign Press Association for this amazing honor. I suppose made more amazing by the fact that I'll be able to say I won this at the last ever Golden Globes. I don't mean to be gloomy. It's just that it has the words Hollywood, Foreign, and Press in the title. I just don't know what... I also think that to some Republicans, even the word association is slightly sketchy.
Hugh Laurie there, Daniel. Of course, Hollywood, Foreign, and Press, all favorite targets of our president-elect, Donald Trump, Daniel.
This is true. And then Meryl Streep, in her Lifetime Achievement Acceptance, began by echoing Hugh Laurie's words and got a second laugh for the exact same punchline, which you can do if you're Meryl Streep. Other people wouldn't get away with that as easily. But yes, certainly it was a theme for some of the night's best moments. And that helped the show, because without those moments of earnest and some would say politicizing honesty, probably it wasn't going to be all that good a show, I think.
We'll come back to Meryl Streep. Remind us just for a moment, the Golden Globes, how they are like and unlike the Academy Awards, the Oscars.
Well, the first way in which they are unlike the Academy Awards is that they are given by a small cadre of foreign journalists, most of whom people have never heard of and most of whose publications people do not know of, who are, let's say, notoriously able to be wooed by certain persuisive tactics. On the other hand, they're...
Wait, like what? Send them a bottle of champagne or what? It's Hollywood. We're all titillated now.
Well, there have always been accusations about vote buying, but certainly the HFPA has made it clear that they don't accept gifts with a dollar value of more than $95, et cetera. That being said, they're always toasted and feted and cocktail partied for months and months and months before the awards.
How many of them vote for on these things?
The answer varies. It's between 75 and 100. It is much lower and smaller than you would want for an award this important to be.
It'd That's be crazy. That's a, you could go out and woo them all.
Oh, and they do. And that is the thing, is if you look at Golden Globe winners, there is definitely a preference for actors and actresses and producers who are good at schmoozing, basically.
It's funny because it can be so sort of idiosyncratic, and yet you get them and people put them right up there in their marketing big time, right alongside the Oscars.
Absolutely. They have made themselves indispensable in the endless pre-Oscars award season, which practically starts in late November and continues until the Oscars. And the Globes have made themselves kind of a centerpiece of that, and mostly people don't question or quibble who exactly is giving them.
70 or 100 foreign journalists, scallywags, I don't know, deciding all that. They can come out with some idiosyncratic choices. It doesn't always line up with expectations. Did you see some of that last night, Daniel?
There was a lot of it, especially on the TV side, where a lot of the shows were new contenders. So I don't think we knew going in if the drama categories were going to go in the direction of Westworld or Stranger Things. And it turned out that the HFPA rather predictably liked the lavish and very intelligent costume period values of The Crown, which won for drama series. But on the other hand, FX is kind of gritty, grimy, sometimes hilarious, but sometimes very moving comedy. Atlanta won on the comedy side, and that was a little bit of a surprise, but also a nice surprise because Atlanta is a great show, and frankly, The Crown is a very good show. So I think they did very well on the TV side in particular with kind of somewhat surprising choices.
Take us through the big movie winners and your reactions.
Well, the biggest movie winner was La La Land, and it won a record number of awards, including wins for Best Picture Musical Comedy and also for stars Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone. And that was somewhat predictable because you have a lot of years where there isn't a true Oscar contender on the musical comedy side, and in this case there was. On the other hand, the motion picture drama category, which is usually seen as the biggest of the Oscar predictors, Moonlight won for drama picture but didn't win any of the earlier awards in the night. So as people look towards the Oscars, people are going, okay, well, La La Land won the most, and that means it's obviously a front runner, but is Moonlight obviously the second front runner, or is Manchester by the Sea, which had Casey Affleck win, is that the second contender? So I think a lot of things are still open after the Globes.
There were some crazy moments. Goldie Hawn came out with Amy Schumer and upstaged her pretty totally there when they were presenting. Just a kind of a wild dynamic.
It was a funny moment, and it was very much a bit. It was Goldie Hawn okay. is the somewhat wacky, somewhat older lady who is valuing vanity and not wearing glasses yeah. over being able to read the teleprompter. That was the gimmick there. There were a number of jokes with actresses that went along those lines, like the Sofia Vergara cannot pronounce words in English. Makes things sound dirty, which is something that the Golden Globes keep doing to Sofia Vergara. I feel very bad about that.
Yeah, we've seen that one
really
before.
She deserves
I want to hear Meryl Streep. Here she was last night. Got the Cecil B. DeMille Award for Lifetime Achievement. Here's a bit.
So Hollywood is crawling with outsiders and foreigners. And if we kick them all out, you'll have nothing to watch but football and mixed martial arts, which are not the arts.
Okay, and then she went straight at President-elect Donald Trump's offensive behavior. citing when he insulted a disabled reporter all the way back months ago on the primary campaign trail.
There was one performance this year that stunned me. It sank its hooks in my heart, not because it was good. There was nothing good about it, but it was effective and it did its job. It made its intended audience laugh and show their teeth. It was that moment when the person asking to sit in the most respected seat in our country imitated a disabled reporter.
She didn't name Donald Trump, but straight at him, and then this from Meryl Streep.
This instinct to humiliate when it's modeled by someone in the public platform, by someone powerful, it filters down into everybody's life because it kind of gives permission for other people to do the same thing. Disrespect invites disrespect. Violence incites violence. When the powerful use their position to bully others, we all lose.
Daniel Feinberg in California, in Pasadena, how did that go down last night? Was it an embattled crowd there under the pretty frequent attacks of Donald Trump, or sort of dukes up, ready to rumble?
It seemed like a crowd that was very much on the same wavelength as Meryl Streep, and that's somewhat predictable. And naturally and equally predictable, the responses this morning from conservatives have been, oh, there's out-of-touch Hollywood again, Hollywood liberals out of touch, they don't understand. And the semi-ironic part of that is that it completely and totally ignores the first half of Meryl Streep's speech, which made the point over and over again, using examples for just about every actor and actress in the room, that Hollywood is not one thing, one group of people from one city. It's people from all over whose job is to represent people from all over in movies and TV shows. And so this has become once again a, oh, Hollywood liberals, when Meryl Streep's point was Hollywood liberals are people from all over and people from all over shouldn't be tolerating bullying, which doesn't seem to me to be a partisan sentiment at all.
Donald Trump, of course, tweeting back at her, calling her an overrated actress, the president-elect. Going to be an interesting set of years in front of us with the White House and Hollywood. Daniel Feinberg at The Hollywood Reporter. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you for having me.
On the Golden Globes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.